kids, Matt Segundo here, and this second installment of our Young Roving Correspondents conversation with Tom McCarthy is less frenetic than the first, in large part because various French artistic references were tossed about, and I simply don't understand them. Perhaps you, dear listeners, might be a tad smarter than I.
Well, there's also this idea in the book of guns and weapons. The smell of cordite,
yes,
one thing, but also the ferrous metals, the concern for guns as well. Yeah. I'm wondering, you know, it almost sort of suggests that, taken to its greatest extreme, even more extreme than in the actual book here, that this kind of notion of this solipsistic, desperate pursuit of finding a trajectory is possibly quite dangerous and can be taken to the nth degree.
Oh, totally. I mean, here's the paradox. In the West, the human subject is very much a construct. It's a constructed subject. And yet, installed in this subject, like a kind of bit of software, is this ideology of total natural authenticity. You know, be yourself, realize your dreams, be who you are, who you truly are. They're kind of at odds with one another. And my hero is living out that paradox to the nth degree, really to the extreme. In that sense, he's simultaneously a totally reactionary figure. I mean, he represents the status quo very, very strongly. On the one hand, and on the other hand, he's a kind of revolutionary. I mean, you know, by taking it to its logical extreme, it just collapses. You know, if we took all this shit literally, society would crash in a week, you know. And I think there's also, coming back to the reenactment of the shooting moment, I mean, I think that's a genuinely kind of revolutionary moment, because even more so than robbing the bank, because, you know, this guy is shot, this drug dealer. The police do a few forensic photographs, clean up the blood, open the road to traffic again and to commerce as soon as possible, and erase any trace so you wouldn't know something had happened. My hero refuses that. He keeps saying everything must leave some kind of mark. It's a phrase he keeps repeating. And he will not let that moment go, let the fact that something has happened here, that somebody has died here, he won't let that be erased. And I think there's a kind of heroism. I mean, I know it's kind of perverse the way he plays it out, but I think there's something I find very admirable about that, the refusal to forget or to collude in a sort of collective forgetting. To as Levinas would say, to bear witness.
Yeah.
You know, that's the ethical imperative. Just to bear witness, to say, no, this did happen, actually.
Yeah. I wanted to actually talk, we were talking, you alluded to it many times, I didn't even get a chance for you to expand upon it, but this idea of the protagonist as an artist through these reenactments, it reminded me very much of the way Antonioni sort of created his films about painting these entire streets white and blow up and the like. And I'm wondering, if were there any particular sort of artistic figures or pop art people?
Very much so, absolutely. I mean, number one has to be Warhol. I mean, in my opinion, he is simply the greatest artist ever to have lived, including Michelangelo and everyone.
And you're an artist too, I should point out, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, Warhol's visions of, repetition, banality, this kind of psychotic banality of violence, you know, the endless car crashes, which are at once kind of treated with contempt and disdain, as though it were just another image. And on the other hand, kind of in almost a Catholic way, memorialized, you know, monumentalized, I mean, rendered sacred. So the most mundane street accident can be as significant as the crucifixion. So Warhol, also, I was very struck by something Warhol said, which was that, he said, I always kind of half suspected throughout my life that this was all television. I wasn't really living, I was watching TV. After I was shot, I became certain of it.
You know? And then there are his diaries, which are written in a rather strange prose.
Yeah, I mean, this completely disconnected. Yeah.
I know, just like, hey, I met with so-and-so, and I met with so-and-so.
He was kind of nice. I met the Shah. Yeah, he was kind of nice. It's like a revolution. That's kind of a bummer, you know, whatever. But, you know, I sold a painting. But there were other artists that I was thinking of a lot. I mean, I really like Ed Ruscha. And the sort of concern with geometry that he has in his, for example, his car park series, where you just see the geometry of these empty spaces repeating the lines where the cars are meant to park. And I like the Royal Road Test, where he smashes this typewriter down a highway and then goes and photographs, again, forensically, with forensic attention, the whole detritus. Yeah. And you know, so much of Remainder is about the event, which has already happened. You never get the event in the book. The event is always already past. But the event and its kind of representation, or what do you do with an event? You know, that's the central question of the book. How do we deal with, you know, how do we represent it? How do we remember it?
It's almost Lockean to some degree, the settlement, the proper noun, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yeah. I mean, I think this really is a central axis of, you know, of philosophy and but also of literature and of art. I mean, they all kind of blur into each other. But anyhow, I was thinking about artists a lot. While I was writing the book, actually just during and afterwards, I met four different artists in the UK who exclusively do reenactments. So I met Rod Dickinson, who's done reenactments of, for example, the Milgram obedience to authority experiment. He got the scripts and had the fake laboratory that Milgram used to pretend was a real electroshock chamber. He got the transcripts and he looked at the film and he got actors to reenact people that were originally actors, reenacting, although the real is in there. And this is what's interesting, always the fake kind of hides the real somewhere. I mean, the Milgram reenactment, although it was fake, it came out of his reading Hannah Arendt's account of the Eichmann trials. Yeah. So there's kind of it's the Holocaust at the heart of it. But I found his work fascinating. Jeremy Deller, who won the Turner Prize in the UK a few years ago, had done a reenactment of the Orgreave riots between police and striking miners. So in the style of a hobby historical society that reenacts the Civil War or something, he'd done a much more recent event. So treating history itself as a sort of found object, like Duchamp might treat a bicycle wheel.
Yeah.
You know? So I found that, you know, very interesting. But perhaps the most extreme one.
Or a toilet
one,
for that matter.
Or a toilet, yeah. Or turning it upside
down.
There's another couple of artists called Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard that, again, I've got to know and have written about their work in the wake of Remainder's publication. And they did a reenactment at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London. They reenacted a Cramps gig from the 70s. The Cramps had performed at Napa Mental Health Institute to an audience of patients there. And this one little bootlegged handheld video that exists, and they found a copy of this on eBay at a huge expense and remade it. So they hired a band to be the Cramps and to do exactly what the Cramps did in that gig. But the audience were not actors in this case, but mental health patients. So it was a very extreme piece of art. There were people, you know, throwing themselves on the floor, jumping off the stage, cutting themselves, which you would get at a punk gig.
Very reminiscent also of the recent YouTube videos in which they had these prisoners reproducing Thriller.
Yeah.
As well as a Queen song, so, you know.
Right. Yes, yeah. I mean, it's on the edge of total exploitation art. Which, you know, which lots of Warhol's work is too. You could see his whole career is one long snuff film in a way. Yeah. Almost everyone he worked with ended up dead, frankly.
Yeah.
And he more or less filmed them dying, you know. So, I think contemporary art is a very fertile and interesting arena at the moment. In the UK, corporate publishing is going dumber and dumber, and to the point that it's almost excluding literature. And art's picking up the tab. You know, artists have become very literate. They all have read Beckett and Kafka and stuff, and you know, Burroughs, and they're all. Many of them are using text, using narrative in their work. So there's a lot of, I mean, especially with Remainder, I think, you know, artists will see it as a kind of art novel, a conceptual art novel. I don't, but, you know, there's definitely a kinship there.
It's extremely interesting to me that we're talking about this idea of reenactments, because I saw many parallels between your book and William Gibson's Pattern Recognition. In fact, both books have the Michelin Man as
really?
A, yeah, he in
I haven't read that book. I've read some Gibson, but not that.
Pattern Recognition has a character who is allergic to trademarks, and she recoils At the Michelin Man. Really? So I'm reading this, okay. And I'm going, yeah, well, here it is again. So it's another one of those things where and not only that, but he also kind of, he has a sort of situation where he actually sort of anticipated Lonely Girl on YouTube. And this, in its reenactments, as we're sort of discussing here, seems to be likewise a kind of prescient notion of many of the reenactments that one can find on YouTube. I mean, this may very well just be a case where if you access a particular subject, you're likely to hit the same kinds of areas.
But I mean, lots of critics have seen Remainder as a sort of a postmodern parable, or a parable of the postmodern, that, you know, that history's ended and we're just in a chain of repetitions and it's all, you know, to do with digital culture and so on and so on. But, I mean, if you look in literary history, you get exactly the same logic played out in Don Quixote, for example, where Don Quixote reenacts stylized moments from penny novels that he's read in a bid to be more authentic. You know, in Tristram Shandy by Laurence Sterne, Uncle Toby has lost one of his testicles in the Battle of Namur, and so he spends his whole retirement gardening, and he lays out the flowers in his garden in the exact position of the soldiers of the battle. So the red flowers are like the British and the blue are the French or whatever it was. Yeah. You know, even Hamlet sits around doing nothing for half the play and then hires these actors to literally to reenact his father's death scene in front of the whole court as this kind of awkward moment. So, I mean, I think you find these patterns played out right back to the beginnings of literature almost. I mean, I suppose the most contemporary or modern version of it, and one that was very much in my mind when I wrote the book, was Ballard's Crash, which is a fantastic book, and its hero again reenacts car crashes, reenacts stylized violent moments in a bid to be authentic. Ballard makes it very, very clear. He says, you know, the only real thing in this world is the car crash, and therefore we must reenact it and create the perfect one.
So in a bid to be authentic, if there are so many common motifs in the air, is it really a matter of actually sort of establishing the ambiguities that you have in this particular narrative, of allowing for multiple interpretations, or what is the sort of ingredient then to bring a distinct kind of quality to a novel?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I can answer that question, because, as I said, it was just intuitive. You know, I had this moment of deja vu. I realized that was a kind of dynamic situation. I realized it had parallels with literature that I admired and wanted to somehow, you know, dialogue with. But it wasn't really that self-conscious. I mean, with the authenticity thing, you know, the hero wants to be authentic. He fails. The paradox is that in his bids for authenticity, he sets up more and more and more artificial situations, which, again, is exactly what Ballard's Vaughan or Cervantes' Don Quixote do. They go through artifice, you know, to extreme lengths of artifice in order to try and accede to the real. At the end of Remainder, you get not a return to the real, but a rupture within the inauthentic. That's all very abstract. What I mean by that is he's reenacting a bank heist. That's going to be his greatest, biggest scale reenactment. As he goes about rehearsing this, he hires a former bank robber who's now a consultant to Hollywood movies on how to do an authentic looking bank heist, and he finds out that bank staff are actually very highly trained in what to do in a bank heist, to the extent that they've even rehearsed it. Robbers, or good robbers, know what the staff are trained to do. The staff know, the robbers know, and so on and so on. So a bank heist normally is actually an enactment of a pre-scripted sort of contract almost between the putative robbers and the staff. When he finds that out, he says, well, in that case, let's not do our reenactment in a studio. Let's do it in a bank. And don't tell them it's going to be a reenactment, because they'll react the same way. It will be a reenactment, but it will be more authentic because the staff will think it's real. Of course, he's mad. It is real. You know, in law, he's just robbing a bank. In the course of that, something goes wrong. It goes off message, it goes off script, people start getting killed, blood is shed, and without giving the end away too much, everything goes incredibly messy. And for him, this is a fantastic turn of events, better than anything he could have hoped for. He gets the biggest tingling of all, he gets a sort of tingle orgasm almost. And for him, this is, yeah, this is when somebody says, my God, it's real. That's when it really hits. But the real is not getting the script right. It's a rupture within the inauthentic that leads to another level of inauthenticity, but a rupture so kind of violent within already of stylized violence that it becomes real. Yeah.
It occurs to me now in describing this whole reenactment of a bank heist that actually this reminds me very much of the great French film Bob le Flambeur. Bob le Flambeur? The Jean-Pierre Melville movie about the old
guy. Oh, I love him.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I've seen this one.
It's about this guy who, again, old dog, recruited in for one last final score. And they actually reenact the crime right beforehand on a field. And there's this great sort of thing where they actually have, like, the chalk outlines of the bank as they actually, and they're constantly rehearsing this. And but it's interesting.
I haven't seen that, but after Remainder came out, I came across this artist's work. In fact, in a couple of months in Berlin, I'll be exhibiting with him, mm-hmm. and or in a group show in which he'll be also. He's called Pierre Huyghe, mm-hmm. and he'd done a piece with, you know, that movie Dog Day Afternoons?
Yes.
Al Pacino, bank heist, all goes wrong. It's based on a real event. This guy, this gay bank robber, sort of robbed a bank in order to get money for his boyfriend's sex change. It all went wrong, da-da-da-da-da. 20 years or so later, this guy's come out of prison. Pierre Huyghe hooked up with him and said, let's, it's called The Third Memory. Mm-hmm. And Pierre Huyghe had the layout of the bank reconstructed, but in a kind of crappy way with just little wooden partitions to represent the tellers and the booths and so on. And he has the real bank robber, who's by now like 60, walk him around it going, okay, I was here, hang on, now I turned here, then he stepped here. And as he remembers it, the robber, he's going, oh, what happened next? Oh, that's the bit where Al Pacino... He's remembering his own past through the film, through the representation of it, which he's seen 100 times, you know, 300 times in his 20-odd years in prison.
Yeah.
You know, so that's... I mean, there's also apparently a passage in Baudrillard that I've never... I mean, I have read some Baudrillard, but not this bit, where he imagines, you know, what would it be to do a fake bank heist if it were real? And I think as soon as you do something, you find a million precedents, you know, some of which one is aware of and is, you know, very... consciously kind of referencing, and others of which not, but one could be.
I actually wanted to ask you, and yeah, I'll wrap this up very soon, but I wanted to ask you about the food in this book. The sort of, it's really interesting, for example, that the protagonist associates dinner with wine. In fact, when he meets with Nas in the Blueprint Cafe, he actually specifically specifies no wine. And in the two meals in the Blueprint Cafe, it's Ketagri and fish soup both times. And so I wanted to kind of ask you about this sort of association of wine with dinner. I mean, maybe I'm perhaps looking too much into it, and maybe this may just very well be, again, patterns that we want to establish in this book. But
when Naz says, where do you want to meet, he has a picture in his head of lightness and of bubbles. Bubbles are important in this book, the sort of air going upwards towards the sky. The John Gould, the designer that did the cover of the vintage edition, is a genius, and he's got that brilliantly. There's this kind of bubble going through the blue goop.
Yeah.
So anyhow, the bubbles and this passage upwards is I guess why he wants the sparkling water. Kedgeree, I mean, in the Blueprint Cafe, I remember going there and having kedgeree once. Is that?
There actually is a Blueprint.
Oh yeah, there is a Blueprint Cafe. Yeah, okay, it's the cafe of the Design Museum, just by Tower Bridge in London.
Okay.
It's very beautifully designed. When they meet there the second time, of course, he's going to reenact what they did. He has this mindset that every place he revisits, he just makes the scene that happened there last time replay itself, but a little different. So he's always in repetition mode. That time, Samuels, the bank robber consultant, who they're meeting the second time they go there, has venison sausages. And Samuels' moniker in the criminal underworld was Elephant, because he was meant to be adept at making large things disappear, but also because he has a very good memory. He never had to write down the times of when the bank staff go off duty, because he just remembered it in his head. And as Samuels eats the venison sausages, the hero just looks at them and thinks of Elephant's trunks, wrinkles, and just wonders how you can just spirit away so much matter. And then he says, where does this all go? You know, this phrase that keeps coming back. I mean, earlier on, there's the carrot, when he has to relearn all his movements. There's this there's this this carrot, yeah, that he has to hold, and he, so he has to visualize a carrot in his head for months on end with his physiotherapist before actually trying to do it with a real carrot. And of course, when he gets the real carrot, it's too real. You know, his imaginary carrot was just some kind of passive object, but the real carrot is covered in, it's got some dirt on it, it kind of wrinkles and crawls. I mean, I think he even says it's more real than he was.
See, I also thought that the carrot, though, was kind of a neologism because of the scions that come later, you know what I mean? Like, it's some sort of component of the whole. He's trying to kind of find kind of meaning, and so he's starting from these particles and these bubbles, as you say.
At the time, it was just simply a carrot, and there's no particular resonance. But later in the book, when Samuels is explaining to him over venison and kedgeree, about the way a bank heist works, he says they follow a strict action-reaction pattern. A does X, B does Y, A does Z, and the whole thing runs its course. Everything goes smoothly. No one gets killed. Fine. Unless something goes wrong, there's this extra thing that comes in, like a have-a-go hero, an old lady that gets hysterical and screams and runs around. If something blocks it, and the hero goes, like the carrot, you know? And of course nobody knows what he's talking about, but it's his kind of logic. One critic said that's a reference to Beckett, the carrot, which, I mean, if I'm being honest, it's not, but, I mean, it's a great, I'm happy for it to be thought of like that, because
certainly
he's the man, you know. Oh, man, yeah, I mean, you know, Waiting for Godot.
Yeah.
Vladimir and Estragon sit around in the second half and nothing's happening. Then they say, well, let's pass the time by reenacting what happened in the first half.
And then there's also the Beckett play, which I'm spacing out on, but there's actually the actors on stage right who are inhabiting a separate stage where they're basically reenacting a scene that's actually happening on the main stage. And I can't remember which particular...
Oh, I don't know which one that is.
Yeah, I think it's a short one, too.
Okay.
But it's really... And they're like sort of acting in response to what's happening on the stage.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. I was thinking of, you know, in Happy Days, there's... Winnie, who's stuck in a repetition loop. So every day she does the same thing. She gets out her handbag, she takes out her lipstick and a hairbrush and a gun, of course. And it's quite interesting, actually, because she says she's aware of it. So she says, here I am, taking out my lipstick, this brush, a toothbrush, I think it is, and this gun. Like I did yesterday, I'm doing exactly the same thing, which actually means she's not, because, I mean, if you and I come back to this same cafe and have the same rhubarb tart and say exactly the same words tomorrow, it is not... the same event as now. We're kind of, we'd be reenacting. There's a level of awareness, of self-consciousness. And if we did it every day would be different. So it's a kind of, you know, you're creating these skins of past, like a snake shedding skins with every loop.
Yeah.
And, I mean, again, that's, you know, that's something that, it goes back to, basically it goes back to Vico, this 18th century philosopher who had this, way before Nietzsche or Marx, came up with the idea that history runs in loops. And Yeats got very interested with him and developed his whole idea of the gyre, the kind of spring of history repeating on itself as it advances. Joyce picked it up from him. So in Finnegan's Wake, you get... it's this novel in which the event, whatever it is, because you don't really find out, has already happened before the book begins. And what you get in the book is a series of reconstructions, you know, in courts, in theatres, in dreams... And so on, each one more formalized and interpretative and self-conscious than the last.
Yes.
It's kind of endless gyring. And then, of course, Beckett is the pupil of Joyce. So it's this lineage of repetition or of non-repetition. As Deleuze says, repetition can only ever be the repetition of difference.
Are all novels essentially reenactments? Or do you think there's more, I guess, of a focus on reenactments these days? Well, we had mentioned YouTube earlier and how a lot of what is on there are essentially reenactments of other films or other plays or whatnot.
Sure, but then go and look at Midsummer Night's Dream by Shakespeare. You've got a scene in it in which a bunch of Greeks sit on stage watching some theatres do Greek theatre. I mean, it's you know, Marshall McLuhan says the content of every medium, the true content of every medium is the previous medium. So. Yeah. You know, cinema is the content of television and radios and so on. Photography is the content of cinema and back. But, I mean, I think, you know, the whole idea... I mean, Renaissance means... It almost means reenactment. It means rebirth, literally. But what is being replayed in the Renaissance is antiquity. They suddenly discover Ovid and Aeschylus and so on and Plato and say, you know... And they replay it. So, I mean, you know... Shakespeare is at once, you know, the best ever writer and the worst ever plagiarist, you know, because most of his plays had already existed in some form or other. There are so many sequences from Ovid, from Plutarch, and so on, just being sort of boxed and embedded and repeated, although always differently than before. So I think, to answer your question, I think to a large extent the history of literature is the history of repetition.
Is this perhaps one of the reasons why you faced some resistance trying to get this book? I know you had a hard time getting it published. Is it the fact that yours was possibly a more adept reenactment than the so-called rehashes of popular books, of various sorts of derivative novels that...
I mean, I think that lots of mainstream publishing is kind of, to use a crass psychoanalytical term, you know, in denial about literature, you know, I mean, you know, they or about modernism at least, you know. I mean, you talk to people in publishing, they haven't read Beckett, they haven't read Kafka, Joyce, you know, it's kind of like middlebrow entertainment. When I was trying to get this book published at first, I had enormous difficulty and people were saying, like, why doesn't anything happen? Why is he just repeating stuff? And I'd go, well, you know, have you read Beckett? And they were like, no. You know, what are his sales figures? You know, but the way it did get published was perfect in a way. I hooked up with this French art press who didn't even consider themselves a publisher. They were these curators, Clémentine Delis and Thomas Boutou, based in Paris, who had become very interested in the history of Olympia Press, which is run by this maverick publisher, criminal mastermind, general chancer called Maurice Gerodius. And he was the first person to publish Burroughs, Nabokov, lots of Beckett. You know,
Henry Miller, too. I believe.
Henry Miller, absolutely. And he made his money from porn, soft porn. He published the novels at a loss just because he really liked novels. Or like these writers. And then to bring his two markets together, he produced these little pamphlets that he called Le Teaser, in which on one side of the page was porn and on the other side was a passage from, you know, Beckett or something. And he also got the authors to write porn pieces under pseudonyms.
Yeah.
So that was the sort of triangulated setup he had. Clémentine Delis and Thomas Boutou in 2004, 2005, wanted to reenact that, to restage it. So they hooked up with three novelists, well, and a fourth, but he was dead with his estate. And they brought out these four novels. They also commissioned pornographic works from artists. So they were less porn and more art, frankly. And they produced Le Teaser, a series of teasers in which, you know, there'd be an excerpt from Remainder on one side, some photograph by a often quite famous, you know, contemporary artists with mildly erotic content on the other. And then on the next page, a passage written under a pseudonym. Mine was Susie Mabbitt, which I'm sure any French listeners will have no trouble understanding.
Getting in touch with your feminine side.
and so he wrote pieces of porn as well. But the books looked, typographically, they looked like the Gerodius books. They had the same design and the same sort of print font and so on. So it was kind of a... Remainder was first brought out within a conceptual art project, you could almost say. And in terms of their distribution, they only let it be sold, or they only distributed it to galleries, bookshops, gallery bookshops, and a very few independent retailers. So when Remainder started getting quite a lot of press and the chains were contacting them and saying, can we stock it? They said, no, you can't. You know, people can go to the Tate, they can go to the Institute of Contemporary Arts. We don't need it to be, you know, on the shelves of Borders, which, I mean, frustrated me at the time. I was going, give it to Borders, Jesus!
Yeah.
You know, but now I completely respect their logic. Of course, then it was picked up by bigger publishers and it is in Borders, and so everyone's happy, including me. But I think, you know, to actually make that statement, that Clémentine Delis was very adamant that art is the arena in which literature and literary ideas and fiction is being kind of developed, not mainstream publishing, and she wanted to keep that, you know, that distinction. And I kind of respect what she was doing.
Gotcha. Well, is there any hope for, I guess, a sort of, I guess, middle brow sort of scenario in which these highbrow authors merge with this rather popular form? Was this your intent with Remainder in some respects? Or?
Not really. I mean, you know, it's not a difficult novel to read. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not avant-garde. It's not sort of reader-resistant like Finnegan's Wake or sure. William Faulkner or something. I mean, it's very, you know, some guy says, then I did this, then I did that. I mean, it's quite conventional. I suppose it's not conventional in as much as nothing happens. I mean, there are no events, only repetitions of other events that may or may not have happened. I think the best pieces of literature or any art, in fact, do what they have to do as simply as possible. I mean, you're in a communication situation. You've got to make it work, communicate as directly and simply as can be done. And that is the case even in Faulkner. You know, he has written The Sound and the Fury in the simplest way it could have been written. It's just very complex, you know. But, you know, I mean, books like The Great Gatsby are very easy to read, or in fact, Crash, or, you know, many, many wonderful books are very easy to read. And I wanted Remainder to be easy to read. I mean, there was also the question of, we touched on this earlier, the guy is kind of an artist. In a way, it's not just, one allegorical reading could be that it's a reading of what it is to be an artist, what it is to create or to represent the world. But if he actually were an artist, the book would be over before it had begun. And for even if he were an intellectual, he'd stand in front of the crack and have his moment of déjà vu and go, oh, this is a bit like in Proust when he eats the Madeleine and, you know, has an understanding of the whole structure of memory. And then there's no point. You know, the book's over. So it was really important to kind of banish art and all highbrow content at one level in order to really replay it at a more visceral one.
So for you, it's really a matter of actually writing in the simplest possible form and embedding meaning within simple sentences?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The whole set of concerns that this guy has, which are very, or at least which mirror quite abstract philosophical thoughts, the whole movement from Plato's idealism through to Bataille's materialism and blah, 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 my guy plays them out at a very material and visceral level. So he doesn't sit there thinking, you know, what is the real versus the material world. He looks at a mark on the pavement. In fact, he prods his finger into bits of gunk on the pavement and then later into wounds in people's bodies that he's caused in order to experience matter and the world. You know, he lies on a sidewalk and looks at the angle of leaves and cigarette butts and their texture and their surface in order to experience these questions. I mean, it's very, in a sense, it's very unintellectual. It's very material. And I mean, for me, that's really, you know, what writing's about. You know, to a large extent, you're engaging with the world in its recalcitrant materiality and it's just uncompromising there-ness. And you're trying to somehow bring it over in language, into language. And if you do your job properly, you will fail. It's the paradox. Good literature doesn't work. It's an experience of failure in front of the world. One writer who really gets this is the French poet Francis Ponge, who wrote a series of prose poems called Le Parti pris des choses, like siding with things. Or taking up the challenge of things, in which he writes these prose poems about just objects like a cigarette or an oyster or an orange. And in the orange one, he sort of says, you know, what happens when you express an orange? And there's a kind of pun, because to express is to represent, but also literally to squeeze it. He says, you know, you'll get something out of it, but there's always going to be a husk left behind. You know, there'll always be a remainder, he almost says. And also, you're going to get gunk all over your fingers. It's almost as though you've prematurely expelled all this seed. This is kind of almost sexual failure in front of the world, which nonetheless is a violent encounter, leaves mess, leaves some sort of extraction or juice, and also leaves a big residue. And his work is fantastic. Anyone listening who has not read Francis Ponge, P-O-N-G-E, I strongly recommend it. You can get it in dual text, English on one side and French on the other. Can't remember who the publisher is. But to come back to your question, that this is kind of what's going on in Remainder. It's this encounter with the material world in which both subject and object are dented, and the text is kind of the the residue of that collision, of that disaster, that accident.
Well, Tom, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Since I have made you, girl, you ruined my brain.